Tech, WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and WNST.net. I'm cramping up, and I want to thank everybody here at Fadley's for finding bananas and water for me.
There you go.
We're down at the Fadley's at Lexington Market. We have Don Fry from the Greater Baltimore Committee. I'm sitting, I'm standing, we're on the video. What episode? 18?
Episode 16, volume 3.
No.
Are you like 16, episode 16, 17, 18?
I don't know what we are. Listen, you know, this is our final segment, and I want to get to the gems of Baltimore, like Lexington Market. We're going to talk about all this. We're going to bring some crab cakes out. We had some donuts. Two things. Last segment, you talked about leadership. And when I was here talking to the Vine family and the Fadley family, we've been here 150 years. So I met Governor Schaefer being here and leadership back in the day and the people that have been involved. You mentioned leaders like Sondheim and leaders like Rouse and Governor Schaefer and other people that made this happen. We're wondering where that next group is coming from, right. Where the thought leaders are going to be. And I want to wind you up on that, because when I say to you, if I said this personally, privately, come with me, tell me 12 people in this city who are the leaders, who are real leaders. And I beat up Angelos, and I've given Bisciotti a hard time. I'm talking about people that are physically here, not rich people living on a boat who have an investment here, or the GGV Corporation or the Ashkenazi Corporation giving it away to the other corporation. I'm talking about human beings. Who are the leaders here, Don?
Well, again, you have to look at all different areas, whether it be from elected officials, whether it be from community leadership, whether it be from business leadership. Just in general, there's all kinds of leaders that are out there. I mean, I'll give you a couple of them right off
sure.
the bat. Joe Jones heads up a group called the Center for Urban Families. This is a gentleman who will actually have people come in who have had some problems with the criminal experiences, and he will come in and work with them and prepare them and motivate them to be able to go out and find a new job and go out and do something and overcome the obstacles that are there. You see a woman like Sarah Heminger with Thread.
She comes up every time we talk
to
someone.
Yeah, we got to get to her.
We
ask these questions. We're looking for guests.
I mean, that's a group that's a good group that's out there doing tremendous work with young people. They're very challenging, following them through, mentoring through the process, having great results, looking at how they can maximize and expand their opportunities moving forward. Two business leaders, Calvin Butler and Tim Regan. Calvin Butler with BGE, Tim Regan at Whiting Turner. They're the ones who actually built a facility called Touchpoint, where you have Joe Jones, Sarah Heminger, and also a group called Baltimore Core. So it's an area where communities can come in and actually find services and opportunities to do things together. That's a unique way from a business leader to be perspective. And then again, you got leaders in the political arena that are out there all the time, fighting things like we do, along with them on things like Pimlico and losing Pimlico, working with the mayor's office and city council people on the major issues of public safety issues, dealing with. I think Commissioner Harrison is going to be a tremendous police.
Okay, so this is great. So you asked where I was going. Leadership. One. Now, you've given us a dozen, and we'll get to all those folks, and they are recurring names, Don.
All
correct.
The time.
Right?
We hear them over and over.
How about this? Crime. Okay, so you just brought me to the biggest issue that I believe, you know, aside from corruption and reform and government and all that, but
the most difficult weed.
The most difficult weed, the 50-year weed we can't get out of the garden fully, is crime and poverty that creates crime, and then jails that send people back to the street where there aren't opportunities other than crime, and then we have crime.
Right.
And then here we are trying to solve crime.
Over and over.
And I would, you know, put the reality of the crime versus the perception of the crime versus I got on 83 and there were five people on the hood of my car at the corner of Pratt and whatever, and that, I'm sure that this is a recurring theme with businesses here to say, I go everywhere in the world. I walk 15 miles through New York. I didn't see anything look like a squeegee boy. I didn't see anything look like someone in the middle of the street panhandling or sign with a sign. Until that stops, we can't be a great place. We just can't be.
Public safety is the number one issue that the business community has identified that needs to be addressed in Baltimore City. There's no doubt about it.
We don't need Malia for that.
No. there's no doubt. That is top of mind of everybody in the city and from business community, I think even to the neighborhoods. And it's not acceptable to have more than 300 homicides a year. It's not acceptable. It's not tolerable. It's not acceptable to feel like you can't walk out of your business during the day and feel safe walking 3 or 4 blocks to have lunch and come back. That's not tolerable if you're going to be moving. So, but at the same time, we've got challenges to overcome. We're about 500 police officers short in Baltimore City. You can't totally put all of them downtown because then that takes away from the neighborhoods and what needs to be protected in the neighborhoods. So we need to find a way to balance it out and to give the Commissioner
500.
Harrison about 500
I gotta
police
stop
officers
you there
short.
And say, okay, right. So we need to make it attractive to be a police officer,
right.
Correct?
Well, one of the challenges is that we do actually in recent years have had a decent job of bringing people in, be police officers to go through training programs, but the attrition rate is matching what the recruitment rate is. So you're really not making any significant gains.
Two steps back, two steps forward.
Right.
Two steps
and then,
right,
you gotcha. Know, one problem is also they have good starting pay in Baltimore City. They come and get trained in Baltimore City. They work in Baltimore City for 3 or 4 years,
right.
And then Baltimore County takes them away, or Howard County, or Hartford County,
that's
someplace
that's a
like
truth.
That.
There is certainly some truth.
I can't say that I've heard a lot about that, but yes.
The word that you use in the business of that is a lateral transfer class. And the reason that a lateral transfer class is popular with counties, the reason that a lateral transfer class is popular with county officials is that you save a lot of money on the front end in training. So you get folks who've already been through the training, and in many cases, training in very, very tough circumstances, and now they can come in.
They're attractive
and they can
to other counties.
They're attractive to other counties.
Yeah. So one of the things we...
The same way I'm attracted to WBAL listeners, something like that.
The Greater Baltimore Committee looked in depth at the public safety issue, and we feel that there's got to be a two-pronged approach. First of all, you have to have crime control. You've got to have enough police officers. You've got to be able to make sure that the police are doing their job, the state's attorney is doing his or her job, that the judges are doing their own job. It's all part of the system to make sure that people are being held accountable for bad conduct that they have. And the biggest challenge we have in Baltimore City is the repeat violent offenders that exist here in the city. There are, when you look at the numbers of homicides, the perpetrators and the victims, is disproportionate that they've got multiple records already. I mean, I'm not talking about 3 or 4. I'm talking some of them have 8 and 9 prior convictions and they're still out on the
street.
Well,
you come back from Hagerstown, what happens?
Well, and that's
what happens?
And that's the second part of it. Once you're there, and we've got a group working on that now, once you're incarcerated, is the state doing what it needs to do to properly prepare people so that when they come out, you just don't open up the gates and say, here, go live life. You've got to be able to give them some sort of job training skills, some educational type skills, some sort of ability to do something so they don't go revert back to where they had previously.
Re-immersion, right?
Right. So the second prong, though, is a crime prevention. We also have to make sure that we're investing in the neighborhoods, that we're investing in young people, that we're making sure that there's after-school activities, make sure that there's apprenticeship or opportunities, internship opportunities, making sure that there's like the places for them to go, like the old police athletic league centers and things like that. You cannot solve the crime problem without taking both approaches, both prongs of that, doing them both simultaneously and also do them at the same commitment level to do it. If you do both of those, I think you have a shot to pull those off. And I think Commissioner Harrison, having come from New Orleans, where New Orleans has a lot of similarities, and also working through a consent decree like he did down there and doing with corruption within the department and things like that in New Orleans.
New Orleans is done with everything, yeah, right? I mean, starting with a natural disaster that we can't imagine,
yeah, right.
You know what I mean? And picking up the pieces from the business standpoint, from public works and everything that, you know, that's been involved there over the last 15 years. To your point, you want to fish, find a tough guy. Find a guy that, the Ravens, they draft, you read my book, through adversity.
They draft Ravens.
Baltimore's had adversity, and because of that, you know, we're going to come back, and we see these places like New Orleans coming back. Yeah. Let's see. Well, if Baltimore's going to come back, it's going to be stuff that's already here.
Well,
that's awesome. And we're sitting here in Fadley's, and, you know, part of this thing, too, is to say, what these assets that you take on a plane and say, come to Baltimore, what do you say to someone like that?
There's plenty. First of all, we have tremendous higher education institutions in the city and in the region.
And a hospital that saved my wife's life twice. Make sure you mention
and that's,
that.
That's one. First of all, the higher education institutions, I mean, we educate in this region over 100,000 students in four-year schools and over 100,000 community colleges, which are becoming really the entryway into the business place more than anything else. Research and development in Baltimore. I mean, Johns Hopkins Hopkins, University of Maryland, Baltimore. There are not two finer research, medical research institutions than those around, and they're the bookends of Baltimore.
Right.
If you think about the East and West, they're the bookends of Baltimore. Johns Hopkins is the number one recipient of dollars from the National Institutes of Health on a yearly basis, day in, day out. You talked about quality health care.
And the number one employer in the state, I found out. It took my wife getting sick to realize Johns Hopkins employs more people than anybody. Yeah,
so
right?
Huge quality health care.
Keep going, Don. I'm fascinated.
Amazing quality health care in this region more than anything else. Not just Johns Hopkins, not just University of Maryland, but also shock trauma that Don and I are very familiar with. But also when you think about Mercy Hospital, St. Agnes Hospital, LifeBridge Hospital, all the system hospitals are out right there from Franklin Square,
what
Howard
County.
What about
a hospital makes that attractive to a guy with money in New York or Los Angeles or Abu Dhabi who wants to invest here?
If you're going to invest here, you're obviously going to want to have your apartments filled. You're going to want your business locations filled. People will move their businesses where they also know that there's a good quality of life for their employee. And quality health care is a major asset to have for a quality of life person.
What are those big things? Go ahead.
I think hospitals and education is a major one. Transportation infrastructure, mobility, public safety is one of them also. I mean, that's another one. And that's probably, again, as we talked about, the biggest challenge that we have moving forward. When you think about the location of just Baltimore on the I-95 corridor, between Washington, between Philadelphia, up to New York. It's not hard to get any place between 3-4 hours away in a drive. You can get all the major cities that you want to go to.
It is as convenient a place if you're relocating to say, I want to be somewhere where I can go to a ball game here, a concert there, the beach here, the mountains there, an airport here, three airports here. I want to have a boat. I want to fish.
Smithsonian, you
name it. I want to ski. Yeah, right. I want to, whatever I want to do.
Incredible.
That to me has always been, and they'll never take that away. Location.
Yeah, Maryland has sometimes been referred to as America in miniature.
It's true.
And Baltimore is the hub of that America in miniature when it comes to that.
I don't want to gloss over. Yeah. I want to back up to one of them because I think it's a weed, and correct me if I'm wrong, and that is because I agree with you. Transportation is critical. Yeah. And it seems to me that our failure, and again, I'm not interested in pointing fingers. I mean, I was clearly a proponent of the red line.
Right.
I don't need to get into that. But it seems to me that right now, Don, Baltimore has anything but world-class transportation.
I think that's the biggest challenge that we have other than public safety is transportation. The problem with transportation, and when I was in the legislature, I was fortunate enough to chair the subcommittee on transportation and the environment in the Appropriations Committee. The problem with transportation is that it takes 10 to 12 to 15 years for major projects to develop.
Nobody gets to be a hero.
And
right?
You have to get them started, and you have to move them through the whole process. The red line that Don mentioned was 13 years in the making until the rug was pulled out from under us in Baltimore. That was the most significant economic development project in this region.
See, that's what people, Don, and educate our listeners, because this is what's fun about this again. Folks thought of the red line, and full disclosure, I had a cousin that had 15 years of his life in engineering the red line. So when it went away, it was very personal to him. But folks think of it as transportation. What got lost in that discussion was the economic development impact. Explain that to people.
It was a 13.1 light rail line that ran from over by Social Security over to roughly Johns Hopkins Bayview, east-west connection in Baltimore. You talk about transportation. We have a heavy rail line that runs from Owings Mills into the city over to Johns Hopkins.
I got on that the day it was built, and I'm from the east side. I'm from Dundalk, right? So we took the bus, I'm not kidding you, down here to Lexington Market.
Right.
We might have gotten a Fadley's Crab Cake that day. 1984 it opened?
I can't remember.
82, 84? Yeah, I'm giving you the... And we came down, and we took it out, and we took it back, and my parents never got on it again.
Yeah. Right.
But they thought it was going to... Like, I thought this was going to be to Parkville, and there'd be one to... Because I was in New York last weekend, and I see that the people that built that were not around to see us enjoy it and take it to the show and get on the number 2 up on 86th Street and get down. Right. But they put their hearts into it for their kids and their grandkids and for the future, right? And
so
then you have the light rail lines from Hunt Valley down to BWI, Thurgood Marshall Airport. Those two come within 2 blocks of each other downtown and they don't connect.
Yeah.
You cannot have a system that doesn't connect. The red line would have created that system because it would have bisected, effectively bisected bisected those two lines and provided that first east-west. Most people, not most, but a large percentage of people in West Baltimore, that live in West Baltimore, are transit dependent. And many of the job opportunities are going to be more on the east side of Baltimore. So it created tremendous opportunities.
You've got to give them a chance to get to work.
Remember that segment that Jane Miller did? She tried to get, I think it was to Trade Point. Atlantic. It took her two hours and 15 minutes.
You can't have a functioning community like that.
To work. I remember there's a wonderful program, Vehicles for Change, run by
Marty Schwartz.
Wonderful job. And I tell people, one of the most touching events I did as a county executive was to go to an event where Marty gave these cars to people to help them to get to work. And I got an opportunity to talk to each and every one of them. They were riding. What folks don't understand, it's what makes you so angry when people talk about people who are challenged economically as if they're from another planet. These were moms who were getting up 2 hours early to take the bus with their child to childcare, and then taking another hour to work, and then working all day and taking the hour back, and then another couple of
hours. Is this anything you would have known or understand as a school teacher, or did it take you becoming a politician or in the political space to really appreciate that, being a guy who put a tie on, going up to Catonsville, living your dream job 20 years ago?
Well,
I mean, do you have to be in that space to have to know that, Don?
I love that question, because I do think, as someone who lived his entire life in the county, although spent...
I took a bus everywhere in my life when I was a kid, so I'm different. My parents never drove.
We were extremely suburban, but as I said, I had an aunt and uncle, I've said it many times on the show, lived at 612 Allendale Street in Edmonton Village, St. Bernie's Church, the Edmonton Village Shopping Center. So I was familiar with that. But I think what you're pointing to, Nestor, is that if you live in the suburbs, and you tend to be suburbanized. I don't even know if that's a word. I don't know that you do have a true appreciation of how difficult it is. A friend of ours, Don Norris, who was the head of the, he's retired now, but he was the head of the Ed Policy Research Program at UMBC. When he had folks getting their master's degrees from him in educational policy, one of the last assignments he gave them, they had to go 1 month without using a car, only walking or using public transit to get wherever they wanted. He wanted them to come out of that program.
Give me your keys.
And I'll see you in a month.
Dad's taking the keys. Now you go figure it out.
What Don talked about suburbia is one of the biggest challenges that we had. We were very instrumental in getting a gas tax passed or a transportation tax passed for, again, 10, 12 years. I probably sold the bruises to show for it. We hope we're going to get the red line because of that. And the battle we had was that people outside of Baltimore City did not appreciate the need to do that, and felt, why am I going to have my taxes increased to pay for something
I'm
not going to be utilizing? If you want to have a different revenue source, we ought to have a dedicated revenue source just for transit. So my response was, I'm fine with that. Tell me which one you'll vote for. Well, they wouldn't tell me which one they vote for, because they also would not be supporting
when the streetcars went away until the bus got them there quicker. And then all of a sudden, it was a good idea, right?
Well, listen, I don't know where you are on this, Don. I've said to folks all along, let's go back to under Bob Ehrlich and Bob Flanagan, and again, they were on a different side of the aisle than I was, but they were proponents, if you remember, of rapid bus.
Right.
And I've said to folks, at this point where we are now, we blew an incredible opportunity because the funding was in place. It's almost criminal that we blew that opportunity.
Yes.
But we blew it. We can't go back. We can't recreate it. But at this point in time, if we're serious, and I want to go to your number two pillar, job training, educational skills, getting people to work. We haven't had a guest on here yet that hasn't talked about the importance of creating these workforce jobs, these opportunities. You can't do it without transportation.
And when you think about some of the biggest economic development projects coming on board, Trade Point Atlantic, which is all outside of Baltimore City, but still a major, just a neighbor of Baltimore, and then Port Covington, those two economic engines by themselves, you need to get access to those.
Correct.
And people in Baltimore have to be accessed. All people have to get access to those reasonably. And you also have to have the job skills. 48% of the jobs jobs in the state of Maryland are for middle-skilled jobs, people who have a high school.
What's that number again?
48% of the jobs in the state of Maryland are middle-skilled jobs, people who have a high school degree or maybe, but not quite a four-year degree. But only 38% of the people in the state of Maryland have those qualities right now, and that's projected to grow. So there's tremendous opportunity in this region in IT, in construction, in transportation, logistics, all those types of things, to get people educated so that they can have those job qualities to fill the jobs that are going to be needed. You don't need to be an engineer. You don't need to be an attorney. You can make a great living doing those middle-skilled jobs, and that's what we have a lot of people in this region really just need to be ramped up to have that create. Well, and we need to get them to the job places once they have the qualifications.
That last mile that it's been written about over and over and over again, how do we get folks to those jobs? Right. I mean, it's absolutely critical. We were fascinated, and we're going to talk with it about in an upcoming podcast with the folks here at Fadley's. Don, you mentioned earlier today that Fadley's has been in place for 3, 4, 5 generations. Right. What we found out last Friday is the folks you see all around here in this market, they're 2, 3, 4, 5 generation employees. Yeah. They stay here. They're treated well. They have the skill set that you're talking about.
And it's an enduring business. They know they're going to have a job tomorrow.
I hear from businesses all the time, give me somebody who will show up for time, who will dress appropriately, who will treat their colleagues with respect, and who will give me a full day's work, and I can train them what I need to train them to do.
Didn't Freeman say that? It's about citizenship. It's about training people to be good citizens.
So this has been a good one here.
I mean, this is such an important one. Don, without as we move around, talk about, because it comes up, you mentioned Sarah Heminger, but there are so many. Talk about the folks in Baltimore as one of the assets in the foundation world that are doing such good work. Because I think that's something that we're going to talk to a lot of them.
Right.
People don't realize the important role they play.
Yeah, I mean, foundations have been critically important for Baltimore. I mean, I'm taking on major investments in certain project areas, workforce development areas, and education areas. And again, Baltimore has many of them. We're going from the Casey Foundation, from Able Foundation, from Goldsecker Foundation. Just keep moving.
Weinberg Foundation, just keep going on.
And they're doing great things and focusing on things about Baltimore.
Well, these are people who left a legacy of generosity. We go back to leadership. These were leaders.
And they make
they're still leaders, and they're gone, right? Their money is still leading the way. Now, it's what to do with that money, where that gets appropriated, right?
And people are identifying certain areas where they can have impact, whether it be from a poverty perspective. Education is where a lot of this money goes. Healthcare is where some money has been invested in. To, again, make sure people have a better quality of life in Baltimore and make people want to stay here and live here and grow here. Wow. Is moving forward.
That's so powerful. You know, again, to go back to Senator Mikulski, we laughed. She had no need for nostalgia at all. She called it what, Nestor?
No nostalgia.
She was really clear. But in not to offend the senator, but I do want to go back because I think we can learn something from folks in the past. Tell people, because you mentioned him earlier, who don't know Walter Sondheim. Legendary, probably even before Nestor's time. Talk a little bit about Mr. Sondheim. And then, in this sense, if he were here today, in his youth, looking at what Baltimore is up against, what would he be telling us? So tell us what
how would an expert tackle this?
What would he do? What would he tell us?
Well, Walter Sondheim was just a true civic leader more than anything else you can describe him as. And he was a person who didn't necessarily seek accolades in anything that he did. He was a person who was the chairman of the Baltimore City School Commissioners when it was desegregated before Brown versus Board of Education of Topeka. He was involved in that. There's probably not a major commission or task force, particularly because he's very close with William Donald Schaefer, that Schaefer didn't want done, that Walter Sondheim was not heading up. He was the head of the State Board of Education. He did all these types of things. He worked at the GBC offices as a senior advisor until his death when he was 96 years old.
What year was that?
It was probably been close to 10 years ago.
And never lost a step, right?
No. The funny part about Walter, and I love Walter, he said he worked next to me, and then when I became president, I moved down the hall. He used to come in every morning at 8:30 for some of our committee meetings. He he'd usually walk in to see me about 4:30 and say, "Hey, I think I'm going to head out a little bit early." And I was like, "Yeah, I think you've earned, I think you've earned the right to do it. You've earned the right to do it. Don't worry about it." So he'd head up. But the thing about Walter is that he could sit and he could listen. He could be a guy who'd be in the middle of any controversial issue, and I never heard him speak a bad thing about anyone. But he could then galvanize what everybody was saying and throw out some possible solutions that you could find and some common ground that people agreed
to. Right, so
that's sort of what we need, I think, today. And that's what he would like to see, I think, today, is to see the communities and the businesses and the political leadership come together and find a way to make things
so
happen.
So he grabs the iPhone from the Lord this morning. He grabs the Lord's iPhone and he dials up Don Fry and he says, "Don, I'm reading about this Harbor Place. Here's what I think we need to do." What's Walter telling you this morning?
I think Walter is telling me that this is an iconic portion of Baltimore. It's symbolic. It means a lot. We cannot lose those types of iconic measures that Baltimore has had. You need to find a way to make sure that it gets into the right person's hands and make sure that it is revised or is reconstructed in a way that's going to benefit the citizens of Baltimore, not for today, but for the next 30 years.
Better place to stop than ending on the wisdom of Walter Sondheim? I can't think of it.
Well, you know what, man? People are here. I got a guy back here having an ice cold beer. He's we're killing some steamed shrimp here. We're killing some crab cakes. We're Fadley's. We're down here at the Seafood Market. We're going to talk to the Divine Family. And I tell you what, we're going to wrap up with you, but I hope that you stay close to us because we're all in the middle of this, man. We're all in it together, Baltimore Positive. That's what this is about.
Hey, I don't care where people are. If you're in the city, you're out in the counties. Have not been to Fadley's lately, get down to Fadley's. Enjoy it. One of the great, great attractions here in the city of Baltimore.
I'm going to have some coleslaw.
If you can't get to Fadley's today and you're out there in Catonsville, get by State Fair. Tell Evan Brown, thanks for being a Baltimore Positive sponsor.
My man Don Fry, the Greater Baltimore Committee, Don Mueller from the Baltimore County Executive, and my the guy that keeps me in line. I'm gonna come up with a name for you because mentor. So last century,
it's
I don't know what this is gonna be called, man. My uncle that keeps me in line. I'm Nestor. I'm out on Facebook and Twitter and LinkedIn and Snapchat and Instagram and probably down here at Fadley's in Lexington Market and Crab Cake. We are WNST.net, AM 1570 at WNST Towson, Baltimore. We never stop talking Baltimore sports. And positive.